and his skin almost gray. I felt a little sick seeing him. Whatever happened, it could have been worse, and thank God it wasn't. I reached for the intercom button, then drew my hand back. He did not look in the mood for a conversation. We could only chew our thumbnails and speculate as he put himself through decontamination. When he emerged, I did not resist the impulse to embrace him. But he caught me up short as my arms reached around him and politely pressed me away from himself. He gestured gingerly to his left forearm.
"Hairline fracture," he whispered hoarsely. "Possibly."
"Let's go to the emergency room," I said, reaching for his good arm, but he shook his head.
"Debrief first. Call the Otis."
"They can meet us in the ER."
"Here, now."
He staggered down the hall toward the toilets. I telephoned. Rebecca said they could be there in 10 minutes. Erzabek came with them, for Rebecca had been soothing her after the drama of the morning. Tristan sequestered himself in the conference room on a video conference to Frink until the others had arrived. When finally it was the five of us, and the video screen, so long the bane of our existence, had been shut off and unplugged, he glanced about the table at us, then looked down briefly, then back up and said in a heavy voice,
"Les Holgate is dead."
"Excellent," said Erzabet immediately,
before the rest of us could so much as draw a breath.
"He deserved it."
Tristan gave her an angry look. He seemed about to say something, but then contained himself. "That's horrible," I said. "Who killed him?" He shook his head.
"It wasn't a who. It was a what."
He took a moment, briefly pressed his good hand to his forehead, and began again.
"He arranged a scheme that had elements he hadn't considered or thought out. I tried to foil it, but there were unforeseen complications. And then..."
He looked at a loss for words.
"The brewery blew up. Everyone inside of it was killed."
"There was an explosion?"
Frank Oda asked.
"No,"
Tristan said firmly.
"Something I can't describe. Explosion, implosion, turning inside out, being put through a blender, fire, ice. Worse things, too."
Erzabet looked solemn and sighed.
"Diachronicus nirus," she said quietly. "Diachronic,
She made a broad, sideways chopping gesture with both hands.
"Shear. Diachronic shear. There is a separating."
She shook her head.
"I even tried to warn Les Holgate because his ideas were so extreme." "Very bad. I have heard of it, but never seen it."
"What does it mean exactly?"
asked Frank Oda.
"And what do we do about it?"
Tristan followed.
"Can we go back on another strand and fix it somehow?"
asked Frank Oda.
Her eyes widened slightly, and she shook her head.
"Oh, no, no, it's over. His existence, the existence of everything caught up in the shear, it is gone forever, across all strands. You cannot even go to look for him. He's gone. Full stop."
"That's horrible," I said again.
"Why? He was a terrible person,"
said Erzabet, and then softening.
"But I am sure there were innocent people destroyed, too. It is very sad for them and their families."
She looked thoughtful.
"I thought perhaps this was apocryphal, because I never met anyone who had experienced it. The last one in Europe was Paris, 1777. I suppose by my time, everybody knew better than to risk it."
"Who else was lost in this diachronic shear?"
Rebecca asked.
"Grania must have survived, or you could not have gotten back here."
Tristan looked as if another 100-pound weight had settled upon his shoulders.
"She's not the one who sent me back," he said. "After the chaos, the young English witch named Rose found me and offered to return me here."
"We've lost Grania?"
He grimaced.
She's not dead. She's not even physically injured, but I think there's other damage. As well as killing Les, the Lomach took Grania's lover and her boss, and of course destroyed the tear sheet itself, which has been her home for 10 years. She's an unwed Irish woman in Elizabeth's London. The tear sheet was her sanctuary. When I last saw her, she was hysterical.
Of course she was, said Ersebet quietly. She had gone quite pale and still. It is a horrible thing to be torn from your security. This poor woman.
Something didn't add up. How could you leave her in that condition? I asked. For all of Tristan's mysterious ways, I knew him well enough to know that he would not simply abandon Grania.
She's being looked after, Tristan said, at least temporarily.
Who's looking after her?
Athanasius Fugger.
There was a long pause while we absorbed that.
You left her in the hands of a fucker,
Ersebet exclaimed. Why would he, of all people, I began.
I'll tell you what I know, Tristan said. He was there, on the scene. Close enough to see it, far enough away that he didn't get involved, or whatever you call it, in the diachronic shear. He must have followed me and Grania. He helped us up out of the ditch. He accompanied us back to the scene of the fire. Grania was losing it. Fugger puts an arm around her shoulder, draws her in. She's sobbing on his shoulder. He looks up at me. There's something very weird about his gaze, and says, I believe it's time for you to go back to where you belong. You know another witch who can do it. Go and reflect. And he nodded at the fire, then looked back at me in a very serious way. I'll see to her, he added, nodding at Grania. And then he turned his back on me. That was the last I saw of him.
Go back to where you belong. Go and reflect, I repeated. He knows.
They all know, Ersebet spat. All of the fuckers. They always have. How do you think I have survived all these years without my own means? The fuckers knew I was temporarily indentured and saw to it that I remained alive and functional. They know everything.
Well, this particular one knew something, that's for damn sure. Tristan said. In a weird way, I trust him to look after Grania, at least temporarily. It almost felt like Athanasius Fugger came to the tear sheet to clean up my mess.
Our mess, I corrected him.
Les Holgate's mess, Ersebet said.
Anyway, Grania's part of that mess, and Fugger's overall vibe was like, I got this fool, get out of here. So I got out with Rose's help. I don't know what Rose really thinks of this project either now. But she at least was calm enough to realize that there was no benefit to anyone for me to remain. That's why she sent me back. I wouldn't call it a working relationship yet.
Tristan sat back in his chair, wincing from the arm injury, and sighed.
Anyway, so let's avoid 1601 London. Maybe go to early 1602 and see how Grania has recovered. And if she's still willing to work with us.
Frank Oda had been gazing thoughtfully into space.
If Sir Edward Greylock's existence has been obliterated across the multiverse, he said, that should mean the maple syrup boiler does not come into existence in any strand.
Ersebet considered this.
There is possibly some other strand where another investor might be approached to fund it. But I would say you are most likely correct.
How long will it take you to calculate that likelihood?
Tristan asked Ersebet. Immediately the standard look of contempt.
How can I tell you? She said. I have been tricked. Les Holgate stole my summer luggage.
And then a look of horror came over her face, just as it occurred to myself and to the Odas.
Now we may never recover it.
Tristan looked weary.
I missed that. What?
Your rude boss in Washington with the big table, He forced me into sending Les Holgate back to that D-Tap by stealing my Selmol Logip, and now it is lost.
She was so distressed by this realization that she was enervated, and so seemed oddly calm.
This means I will never perform magic again.
Tristan, exhausted, misread her meaning.
Are you saying you quit?
She clearly had not been thinking that until he said it.
I cannot work without my Selmol Logip, she said harshly. It is gone. Because of very bad people. So yes, I will quit. This is all Hülyeség.
She rose from the table.
Where are you going? Asked Tristan, not even turning to look at her. Where do you intend to live and work and pass your time? You're an immigrant without a legal identity and pretty much no marketable skills.
She paused at the door.
Your boss is a terrible man, she said,
sounding on the verge of tears.
He did a terrible thing, Tristan agreed unhappily. And a terrible price has been paid for it.
But your walking away right now does nothing for you, I added.
I cannot send anyone without my Selmol Logip, she said. It is too dangerous.
For a moment, I could see the very, very, very old woman peering out from her stormy youthful eyes.
I might be able to help you with that, said Frank Oda. I was starting to get the hang of it. Give me a few days, and I might have something to show you.
Erzsébet gave him a weary, disbelieving look. Meanwhile, I said, treading gently, you do not need the Selmol Logip to send me back to the 1640 Cambridge D-Tap, and we are so very close to accomplishing this thing. Please do not abandon us quite yet. You will get your share of the money. We'll find your passport in Les's things. We'll buy you new plane tickets to Hungary if we must. You'll never have to speak to Frink again.
There was a long moment as she stood in the doorway, troubled. Then whatever was going on inside her resolved itself, and she nodded once, decisively.
All right, she said. I am not happy to be doing this, but I will help you complete the mission with the sum book. But let us do it now, and be done with it already.
I have already described the events of my deed enough times, for indeed I've lived through them enough times, that I need not recount them now in detail. I now knew what to expect so well, knew the nuances of all these people who thought that they were meeting me for the first time. Although, as usual, Stephen Day, the printer, commented that there was something very familiar about me. Having been clothed by Mary Fitch, hauled by Goodman Griggs, ferried by the handsome brothers, having conned Hezekiah Usher and Stephen Day, having avoided the lechery of the Cooper, having done all of these things as efficiently as possible, I headed out on the Watertown Road in the soggy August air, sealed bucket under my arm, using the shovel as a walking stick, praying that this time I would not see that fucking... I would not see that boiler foundation. I did not. The erasure of Sir Edward Greylock from Elizabethan London had likewise erased all his possible investments, including this one. Heartened by this, I measured out the length of my arm away from the boulder and dug the length of my arm in depth. The clam and oyster shells seemed like old friends as I unearthed them. I settled the bucket in the hole, shoveled all the soil back in, stamped it down with unwanted exuberance, and headed back, a final time, toward Cambridge. And then, as ever, returning through the town, across on the ferry, back along the oxcart path, to the home of Goody Fitch. A final conversation with her and her young daughter Elizabeth about working with us. And then, home.
Journal entry of Rebecca East Oda.
August 22nd. Temperature, 89 degrees Fahrenheit. Dusty, dry. Barometer steady. Lettuce bolted. Kale ready to harvest, but will be too bitter. Perennial herbs in fine form. Asters, magnificent. It finally happened today. In the former vegetable garden, which had been dug up so often earlier in the summer, but lately lay unmolested while Tristan went to the London D-tap. We gathered around it. Mel dug a hole. Tristan has one arm in a homemade sling he had fashioned from two T-shirts tied together, and could not dig. Erzabet was in stockings and heels. Mel insisted Frank and I are age-exempted. So she dug it all herself. No doubt it gave her satisfaction, for all the time she had to bury it before. And there it was, the barrel, quite small and very old, and soft around the edges where damp had found its way into the wood, but not rotted away. That cooper knew his business. I have not been to a D-tap. I was not in residence during Erzabeth's first few weeks exploring her powers in the Odek. Other than seeing her transform herself, this was my first concrete experience of magic. I have seen that plot dug up a dozen times, and it has never contained a small, well-sealed barrel containing an unspeakably valuable 17th-century hymnal. Until today.
Dia Chronicle. Days 391 to 436, September to October, Year 1. In which we sell a book. The catastrophic deed from which Les never returned, and the recovery of the Bay Psalmbook from Frank and Rebecca's backyard, occurred at the beginning of the final week of August. Not until early October did we actually bank the money. In the meantime, General Frink continued to sign our paychecks, for our recovery of the book had saved our bacon politically. As with General Schneider, Les Holgate's death was deeply and sincerely regretted, but apparently considered to be just one of those things that happened when patriots went into harm's way for the defense of their homeland. So September was a month of unruffling all the legal feathers, getting the I's dotted and the T's crossed. Frink's brain trust concocted a story to explain Les Holgate's disappearance. It wasn't a very convincing story, but it didn't need to be. Friends and family of people who worked in clandestine service knew that mysterious, unexplained death was something that happened. There was a no-casket memorial service for him. This was attended by his family, including his uncle, Roger Blevins, who, like Tristan and myself, flew down from Boston. There was, obviously, no interment, but at the solemn reception afterward, in a bland conference room with recessed fluorescent lights, we were fortified with bad institutional coffee and Royal Dansk butter cookies. Tristan and I were there to represent the Cambridge office. The others had sent cards and flowers. I had hoped to avoid Blevins. Our turbulent past included two incidents of sexual harassment that would have sufficed to get any other man fired. Somehow, however, he cornered me at the hazelnut-flavored cream dispenser, all smiles and smarm. "I'm sorry for your loss," I said, refraining from direct eye contact.
"It's terrible," he said, slightly hurried, as if to get the formalities out of the way. "But I must say, Mel, it's good to see you landed on your feet. I don't need to tell you how concerned I was when you left the department so suddenly. I was afraid your head was turned by, let's say, non-professional considerations."
He gestured vaguely toward Tristan. Tristan pivoted and took a stride in our direction. I hadn't told him about the harassment, but he knew how to read me, and he seemed to have an overdeveloped damsel in distress radar. "I've no regrets," I said, deciding to skip the creamer.
"Oh, neither do I," Levin said. "It's a far better fit for you."
The insult didn't need to be spelled out. You were going nowhere in academia.
"It's an excellent fit,"
I heard Tristan say from over my right shoulder. Levin's eyes rose to see him. Tristan rested his hand on my upper arm and squeezed gently.
"This woman is the most talented linguist, translator, scholar, and researcher I've ever encountered. And a brilliant team player. Worth her weight in plutonium. Thank God we ended up with her." Listener, I do believe I blushed the slightest bit with pleasure. Blevins gave us both a forced smile, as if somebody were tightening his belt without his consent.
I've been a mere advisor until now, as you know, and my involvement is to be ramped up, or so I'm told,
he said, with a glance across the room at General Frink, who was offering his condolences to Les Holgate's mother. It was a classic Blevins move, making it seem as though he was being drawn unwilling into the project, affecting a sort of patrician befuddlement. Tristan's hand almost imperceptibly tightened around my arm.
So I'm informed, he said. I've been working with General Frink and Dr. Rudd for years on the precursors to Dodo, always on the assumption it would peter out. Never saw myself as the co-founder of a new department. But life takes us to surprising places.
Tristan's grip now tightened considerably. Shut up, Stokes.
When I approached you, sir, you refused involvement in Dodo, he said. Not exactly, Colonel Lyons, said Blevins,
always happy to seem wiser than anyone else.
I was just making it clear that I wasn't right for that particular role. Which?
And here he had the audacity to reach out and pat my left arm.
Clearly was the right move, as it left a space open for our Mel here to fill. I knew my skills would be better applied elsewhere, as is proving to be correct.
He smiled.
I look forward to working with you. Just like old times, Mel.
We had made no preparations whatsoever for actually selling the book. We'd hardly even thought about it. Once it was in our hands, we realized that this was going to be complicated. The mere existence of Dodo was a highly classified secret, so we couldn't very well sell it openly. To make a long and tediously legal story short, we ended up establishing a private trust to act as a front operation for Dodo. It was called the East House Trust, and the story was that it was the legal owner and custodian of Rebecca and Frank's house, with the two of them being its trustees. As such, the trust now became the legal owner of the book, which had, after all, been discovered on the property. Rebecca and Frank named Tristan and me officers of the trust, with authority to conduct certain business operations, and on that authority, we opened an account at a bank in Harvard Square and rented a large safe deposit box where we placed the book for safekeeping while we entered into negotiations with various auction houses. Expert advice was that we would get the highest price in New York or London, and that we should wait for a few weeks so that the auction house could advertise the book and spread the word to collectors around the world. So it was that in the first week of October, Tristan and I flew down to New York, he carrying the book in a locked metal briefcase. Sitting in the window seat, I gazed out at the fall colors sweeping down across the countryside from the north. The forests of Connecticut were nearing their peak in a glorious carpet of fiery red. I couldn't help thinking of Goody Fitch, who had been dead for over 300 years, but who, to me, was every bit as alive as Rebecca and Ersebet and the others. After all, with the assistance of Ersebet and the Odek, I could go and visit her any time I wished. And so, to me, she really was alive. How would she and the others in the Colonial Boston DTAP look upon the changing of the leaves? Probably as a warning of bitter cold and hard times to come. The auction house was on Fifth Avenue, across from Central Park, and not too far from the Met. The neighborhood was, of course, where the richest people lived, and had been living for a long time. And so as we walked into the establishment and conducted our business with the proprietors, I had the comforting sense that we had come to the right place. Our copy of the Bay Songbook was the 14th and last item on a list of high-priced antiquities that were auctioned off over the course of a couple of hours. I'd grown up in a family that respected books and old things, but I'd never experienced anything remotely like this auction. Sitting there in my new skirt suit from Lord & Taylor, and my mom's best strand of pearls, watching the rich people and their representatives bid millions of dollars on various ancient artifacts, was a view into another world, as strange to me as anything we could have visited through the Odek. The Bay Psalm Book had clearly attracted the attention of several well-heeled, highly motivated collectors, and so the bidding was intense. In moments, it had blown through our expected price of $5 million and shot upwards from there. Not until we got above $10 million did bidders begin dropping out. It came down to a bidding duel between a collector from Los Angeles, who'd been sitting in the front row the whole time, and a man who had walked into the auction house and taken a seat at the back only moments before the bidding had started. In the end, the latter won, calmly nodding to the auctioneer whenever the man from L.A. raised his bid. The entire process had lasted less than a minute. The book sold for $14 million. I assumed that payment and the physical handover of the book would be taken care of later with the buyer and the auctioneer, involving lawyers and bankers and so on. But after the auction finished and the room cleared out, the man who had bought the Bay Psalm book walked up the aisle, pocketing a phone on which he had just finished making a call. He was dressed in an impeccable dove gray suit, with a vest under the jacket that gave it a distinctive look. Either retro or fashion forward, I had no idea. He was in his 50s, well-built, trim. He was groomed meticulously, but a bit oddly, with sideburns that were longer than the norm. He wore rimless eyeglasses with tinted lenses. This detail had been noticeable when he had first walked in from the street. I'd guessed at the time that the lenses were those photochromic things that darken automatically in sunlight, and that they would lighten over the course of a few minutes indoors. But they had not changed. His eyes were still just barely visible behind a gray screen of tinted glass. Tristan and I were standing in the aisle as this man walked by us.
"If you would just give me a minute," he said
on his way by. We were too surprised to answer, so he looked back over his shoulder with a slightly bemused expression.
"I won't be long."
"Of course," Tristan said, just to be polite. But I sensed he was a little uneasy. We were here undercover, pretending that Dodo didn't exist, that we were just representatives of the East House Trust. Our job was to hand the book to the auctioneer, watch what happened, and get out. Not to socialize. We had a flight back to Boston in a couple of hours and a dinner date with our colleagues. But it would be bad manners to bolt out of the place, ignoring a man who had just handed over $14 million. And so Tristan and I drifted to the back of the room while the buyer conducted a discussion with the auction house staff. We looked out the windows at Central Park, which was glorious, approaching peak color. Strollers and bicyclists were out enjoying the crisp autumn day, and park employees were out in force, raking up leaves and fallen branches.
"Beautiful day, isn't it?"
said the buyer, as if reading my thoughts. Tristan and I turned away from the window to see him approaching us. He was holding the Bay Psalm book on which he had just spent $14 million.
"My name is Frederick," he announced.
Then he casually tucked the book under his left arm, as if it were a paperback he just bought in an airport bookstore, and extended his right hand to shake. "Mel," I said, since it seemed we were operating on a first-name basis.
"Tristan,"
said my companion. We shook hands with Frederick. Still keeping the book tucked under his arm, he pulled a nice pair of gloves out of the pockets of his overcoat and pulled them on while moving toward the exit. Tristan held the door open for him and for me. A fortuitous gap in traffic enabled us to cross Fifth Avenue, and a few minutes later, we were strolling in the park together.
"Where on earth did the East House Trust find this remarkable specimen?"
Frederick asked. He moved briskly. Tristan kept up with ease. I had to step lively in my borrowed heels.
"Respecting the confidentiality of the trustees, I'll treat that as a rhetorical question, Frederick,"
Tristan answered. Frederick slowed to a stop and turned toward us.
"It's new," he remarked.
Both of us must have looked goggle-eyed. This amused him.
"The trusts, I mean. Only established a few weeks ago. Oh, no, I wasn't referring to the book. The book is obviously quite old."
He pulled it out from his armpit and opened it up, flipping curiously through a few pages. "You are correct on both counts, Frederick," I said. I found it strange to be looking at those pages, darkened and mottled with the passage of hundreds of years, which I had seen fresh from the printing press only a few weeks earlier. To be quite honest, it gave me a feeling of satisfaction that bordered on smugness. Dodo had come together, as I've explained, in a crazily haphazard and chaotic fashion, with many twists and turns, and a few tragedies that we'd never foreseen. But it had come together. I had traveled back in time on many occasions. I had achieved my mission. Proof of that was right in front of me, in Frederick's gloved hands, and in the enormously swollen bank account of the East House Trust. Frederick turned his back on us a bit rudely and resumed walking. He forked off the main path onto a smaller trail that rambled off through a wooded section of the park. We followed him, kicking through fallen leaves. He said,
"I suppose you're going to tell me that this was discovered squirreled away in the attic or something. And once the East Orders understood its value, they decided to form the trust in order to manage the financial ramifications. I suppose that story hangs together reasonably well."
Lagging half a pace behind him, Tristan and I exchanged a glance. It was a bit difficult to hear him because we were approaching an area where some groundskeepers were cleaning up fallen branches and leaves, tossing the debris into a gasoline-powered chipper that reduced everything to confetti and hurled it into the back of a truck. It was noisy. Frederick drew to a halt not far away from this machine and turned to face us again. I understood. Or I thought I did. He wanted to speak to us privately, without fear of surveillance microphones picking up his words, and so he had moved to a noisy environment.
"Do you know anything about markets?" Frederick asked. "Given your professional backgrounds, Dr. Melisande Stokes and Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons, I'm guessing not really. Oh, you've read the odd article in the business section of the New York Times, and as educated persons, you have some general background on which to draw. I like to think I'm a bit more up to speed on such things, as being related to my profession."
"What profession is that, Frederick?"
Tristan asked. Frederick had tucked the book under his arm again, a habit I found quite annoying, given the rarity and fragility of that artifact. No book collector would have treated it so cavalierly. This had freed his hands. Turning slightly away, he reached up and removed his shaded eyeglasses, folded them up, and slid them carefully into the breast pocket of his overcoat. For a moment, he squinted against the bright golden sunlight of the New York autumn, showing creases around his eyes. He blinked a couple of times and then turned to face us.
"The sort of profession,"
he answered,
"that places me in a position to spend $14 million on a book."
"Touché," Tristan said.
Then his face went slack with amazement. He was staring at Frederick. I turned to look in the same direction, but didn't see anything to explain Tristan's reaction. There was something odd about Frederick's eyes, which took me a moment to process. They were asymmetrical. His left pupil was dilated to the point where the blue iris could scarcely be seen. But the right pupil was constricted, as you'd expect when outdoors in broad daylight.
"It's simple," Frederick said. "But it's not. Supply, demand, individual transactions, such as the one we have engaged in today. Child's play, on the level of a sidewalk lemonade stand. But when billions of them are integrated over centuries, not so simple at all. The resulting flows of information, encoded as fluctuations in prices, shifts in markets, are far beyond the ability of any one human mind to comprehend. Which is why such things are best left in the hands of professionals, with the requisite training, and, if I may say so, lineage. Good day."
Frederick turned his back on us and walked directly toward the wood chipper. The crew members, distracted by their work and rendered deaf by their hearing protectors, didn't see him coming until he was just a few yards away. Then, sizing him up as a gentleman of a certain bearing, well attired, they straightened up and regarded him with a kind of wary curiosity. Frederick acknowledged them with a polite nod, then took a step closer to the roaring maw of the machine while reaching under his arm. Suddenly, I knew what was about to happen, but I could not believe it. Glancing back over his shoulder to make sure that Tristan and I were watching him, Frederick pulled the bay psalm book out from under his arm and gave it an underhand toss into the chipper. The machine made a brief coughing sound, as did I, and we saw a spume of white confetti spray into the back of the truck. Frederick walked away into the park.
"There goes one strange fucker," Tristan remarked. "Let's go home, Stokes."
The Apostolic Cafe had expanded its offerings to include Euclid's Grill, casual buffet by day, fine dining by night, served in the former nave. Tristan and I went directly there from the airport that evening. Waiting for us were Frank, Rebecca, Ersebet, and the newest member of our little band, Mortimer Shore. Mortimer was the historical sword fighter whom Rebecca had recruited from the park and who had trained Tristan in the use of the backsword. He was a tall, rangy Californian with a mop of wavy dark hair and a bushy beard that, as often as not, framed an easy smile. He was double majoring in metallurgy and computer science at MIT, but Tristan had talked him into putting his academic career on hold so that he could go full-time as Dodo's systems administrator and in-house sword-fighting expert. These four had already grabbed the big booth in the corner of the restaurant, reserved under the name of the East House Trust. Resting in an ice bucket nearby was a magnum of champagne that looked expensive. To judge from the high fives and hugs with which they greeted us, yes, even from Rebecca, they were already well into it. We hadn't told them the weird story about Frederick yet, and it wasn't clear that we needed to. Julie, the smart-ass oboist, who always seemed to be our waitress, uncorked the magnum and came to our table to pour flutes of champagne for Tristan and me, and we went through several rounds of toasts. Ersebet, looking like she'd been born with a glass of bubbly in her perfectly manicured hand, was determined to teach everyone how to toast properly, in the traditional European style. You had to look each person straight in the eye as you clinked glasses with them. She was looking more cheerful than I'd have expected, given that her precious Sommelugget was still locked up in some vault in the trapezoid. I said as much to her. She allowed as how she was so very grudgingly chuffed by the success of the venture and her role in it that she had decided to delay her relocation to Hungary until we were able to replace her by bringing forward through time more witches to work in the Odek. Tristan got to the bottom of his champagne glass pretty quickly. He still had a haunted look about him, as if he'd seen a ghost in Central Park. Not really the champagne type, he raised one hand and hailed the smart-ass oboist. "What can I get you?" Julie asked.
"The usual,"
he said, his attention already on the dinner menu. She faltered, her face pinkening slightly.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I feel like I should know what that is, but the memory escapes me."
"Old tear sheet, best bitter,"
he said, glancing up. She frowned.
"I don't think we have that," she said. "Is it an import?"
He gave her an Eagle Scout smile, but his tone was firm.
"You know, I've been ordering it since this place opened. You definitely carry it."
"All right," she said with a skeptical smile, writing. T-E-A-R-S-H-E-E-T?
Bitter. "That's right,"
said Tristan. We all perused the menu until she returned a moment later with the announcement that they did not carry, and had never carried, Old Tearsheet Best Bitter. Tristan half stood up and looked incredulously over at the barman, who shrugged broadly, indicating he had never heard of that ale. That ale he'd been pouring Tristan for years. Ersebet tugged at Tristan's sleeve, pulling him back down into his seat.
"This is the Diachronic Shear," she said quietly. "There is no Tearsheet Brewery. After September of 1601, there never was."
"That's almost as big a tragedy as losing Les Holgate," Tristan muttered under his breath.
It was oddly intimate, yet oddly formal,
the six of us sitting around a proper dining table that was not littered with coffee cups, whiteboard markers, handheld devices, and notepads. That we were holding actual silverware and napkins larger than a coaster. That we allowed a stranger to approach us and do something exquisitely mundane. Serve us a meal that was not delivered in to-go containers or rewarmed in a microwave. That we ate slowly, savoring our food and relaxing in the hum of conversation around us and feeling a part of the human race. Or at least, that fraction of the human race that frequented the Apostolic Cafe. As we ate, we reviewed our lessons learned about the use of time travel, all of which Erzsébet felt the need to point out she was already aware of.
"Very well," said Tristan, setting down his fork. "If you know everything, save us the time and aggravation and tell us what we don't know yet."
She made a titching sound and shook her head. It is fair to say her condescension toward him was softening now, a little, into something more resembling big sister exasperation.
"What you do not know is almost everything, quite literally. Except what my summer logep could anticipate on any given strand."
"Clearly we're still in the learning process there," said Tristan. "We need to think in a little more depth about how to master the strands."
"You cannot master the strands," said Erzsébet. "It is like a doctor with medicine. You can only practice. And you cannot do even that without the summer logep."
"It does seem to me there are discernible algorithms regarding the strands," said Frank Oda.
He touched his wife's wrist gently, and she reached down to the floor for a book bag, which she raised and handed to him.
"There is always, what is the term, wiggling room," corrected Erzsébet.
"It is a complexity theory problem. A branch of what mathematicians call graph theory," said the professor.
"Graph? As in graph paper?" I asked.
"Math geeks use the term differently," Oda said, "to mean structures of nodes connected by branches, like a summer logep, or Grania's broom, or Rebecca's heirloom."
"Or the many forking strands of history," Rebecca said.
"Point B. A lot of progress has been made in recent decades around just these sorts of problems," Oda said.
Anticipating an objection from Erzsébet, he added,
"Which isn't to say there's no more wiggling room. But we can tackle these questions now with well-tested algorithms and graphical UIs."
He opened his bag and reached inside.
"We are better than any other humans at extrapolating from what the strands tell us."
"That's true," said Frank Oda.
From the book bag, he withdrew an iPad. Rebecca took the bag from his lap and returned it to the floor as he set the iPad on the table before him.
"However, computers can enhance and sharpen the abilities you already have. With all respect, even witches can benefit from an app."
Erzsébet looked at the iPad.
"What is this?"
"It's a present," said Frank Oda. "I would not insult your history with the missing summer logep by calling this a replacement summer logep. So, let us say it is your kipu."
"That is a computer," she argued. "It is a piece of machinery. It does not even have moving parts."
Frank Oda smiled at her, undisturbed by her attitude.
"I took the premise of the kipu and what you had shown me of your summer logep, and I designed a program to do algorithmically what you do intuitively, plus a graphical user interface to go with it."
He held up the iPad so that everyone could see it. On the screen was a branching diagram that might best be described as a mathematician's attempt to reproduce the structure of those devices used by the witches. Call it a kipu, a broom, or a samalogep, if you will. They all had the same many-branched structure, and so did the thing that Oda-sensei had rendered on this screen. It was a constellation of small gleaming figures in various shapes and colors like a Christmas tree. The structure that held it together
was a snarl of fine colored lines. He dragged his finger on the glass, and the thing rotated around, showing that it was three-dimensional. He swiped, he zoomed, he tapped, and things happened.
"It's a work in progress," he said shyly. "But with time and resources, we should be able to build it up."
Ersebet looked profoundly insulted.
"You are saying you can replace me with a machine?"
"Not you. You're Samologip," he said. "Except even better."
Every so often, Frank said exactly the right thing. This was one of those times. Ersebet's face softened. She reached out for the iPad. He handed it to her. She pulled it into her lap and gazed at it in fascination. Her fingers began to move across the glass, halting at first, but quickly gaining fluency.
"Dude, that's sick,"
said Mortimer reverently.
"That's beautiful," said Julie, the smart-ass oboist, pausing at our table with a pitcher of red ale and a platter of onion rings.
"That looks like my grandmother's yow just swunchy."
And before any of us could think to question her, she had moved on to deliver her burden to a table of bearded CS nerds. Scholars. Oda-sensei went on.
"If we had something like this in place, fully realized, for the Bay Sombo Gambit, for instance, it might have predicted the possibility of the maple syrup boiler being there, if we didn't first go back to the earlier DTAP and deal with Sir Edward Greylock and his investment schemes. It might have predicted the danger of Christopher Marlowe being in the Tershi Brewery that day."
"It would take forever to imagine all such possibilities," I objected.
"It's not just about imagining," he replied. "We can integrate this with historical databases, and we can improve those databases as we go back in time and learn what actually happened."
"I don't know," I said. "We have all just had a very sobering lesson as to why nobody should rely on diachronic travel ever. And instead you respond by saying, oh, let's find a way to rely on diachronic travel."
"I'm pretty beat up," Tristan admitted. "But I'll bet the first person to survive an airplane crash 100 years ago was pretty beat up, too. You can limp away from the crashed airplane saying, man wasn't meant to fly, I am done with this. Or you can be saying, I just learned how to do it better next time."
"What's the point of it? Why even bother?" I asked. "We went to all of that effort and people died, so we could make $14 million. We'd have been money ahead if we'd just founded a tech startup instead."
"There are other powers in this game, too," Tristan said, "who can do what we can do and who most definitely think there's a point. We can't let them have a monopoly on this kind of force."
"So it's back to the magic gap argument."
"In a word, yes."
Ersebet had been oblivious to the conversation ever since she had seized the iPad, but now she broke in with a question for Frank.
"So many different colors and shapes of little blobs. What is this one? The little white cloud with the question mark?"
"That's where the system is telling us it needs more input."
"Input?"
"Information about something that happened in the past."
"It knows about known unknowns?"
Tristan asked. I gave a little snort, thinking he was making a joke at poor Les Holgate's expense. But it seemed he was serious.
"Yes," Oda-sensei responded. "This is a case where we would have to send a doer back to collect information."
"Holy crap," Tristan said. "How much computational power?"
"More than can fit in an iPad," Frank answered, cutting him off. "This is linked to a small cluster running in the cloud. But it's still just a toy. It needs to be scaled up radically. To be really useful, it will take an immense amount of computing power."
With an almost impish smile, he added,
"We're gonna need a bigger kipu."
Part 3. Excerpts from Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on proposed extension of black budget funding program for diachronic operations. Days 573 through 576. Late February, Year 2. Senator Hatcher.
Professor Oda, I draw your attention to this rather large document that was produced by Dodo staff during the post-mortem analysis phase from the Les Holgate tragedy. Are you the author of the section of the report entitled Diachronic Shear, a Layman's Guide?
Frank Oda.
Yes, I am.
Hatcher.
To be frank, as a confirmed layman, I found that your explanations only made me more perplexed than I was to begin with. I have some questions about this.
Oda.
I'll try to be of service.
Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Senator Hatcher, if I may just insert a brief remark.
Hatcher.
You may.
Lyons.
This phenomenon isn't well understood by anyone just yet. All we know is that it exists. We've seen it ourselves, and witches have attested to it. So any scientific hypothesis should be regarded as preliminary.
Hatcher.
Thank you for that careful hedging, Lieutenant Colonel Lyons. I'm sure that your subordinates appreciate your paternal concern for their well-being, but I wish to address Professor Oda, if that is fine with you.
Lyons.
Of course. Thank you, Senator Hatcher.
Hatcher.
Professor Oda, would you be so good as to explain the relationship of Jell-O to diachronic shear?
Oda.
Excuse me, Senator. Jell-O?
Hatcher.
Yes, it says here on page 793, third paragraph, that the properties of Jell-O, as in Jell-O brand gelatin desserts, have something to tell us about the structure of the universe, and I found that to be a somewhat unusual statement from a man of science. I was wondering if you might elucidate it.
Oda.
Yes, I remember that section. Traditionally, we have tended to think of the past, present, and future as parts of a single continuous line, a thread, if you will.
Hatcher.
And if I may just interrupt you there, Professor Oda, we have already been over this topic of quipus and so on ad infinitum, so we don't need to belabor any more the idea that it's not just a single thread, but a whole network of them. I think that I understand it as well as any non-scientist can understand such a thing. Just as I felt I was achieving some level of comfort with that idea, you jumped to Jell-O. My great state happens to be home to no fewer than three different state-of-the-art industrial facilities that are part of the supply chain for Jell-O brand gelatin desserts, and so naturally my interest was piqued, but I'll be darned if I can follow your reasoning here.
Oda.
If you have ever observed the properties of Jell-O, such as a molded dessert made of that substance.
Hatcher.
I have, Professor Oda, on many occasions on the campaign trail.
Oda.
You'll know that it is flexible and deformable, up to a point. You can tap it with your spoon and it will jiggle. You can stretch it. But if you overdo it, the material will rupture. A crack will form, just like a crack in a block of stone. Later on, the crack may heal itself. The gelatin can knit itself back together.
Hatcher.
Especially if you reheat it.
Oda.
Exactly. Which is not true of cracks in granite and other brittle materials.
Hatcher.
It is truly a marvelous property of Jell-O.
Oda.
You could say so, yes.
Hatcher.
But what is the relationship to this dreaded phenomenon of diachronic shear?
Oda.
Viewed from the standpoint of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, you could think of the past as being not a single thread, but...
Hatcher.
A quipu, yes, we've been over that.
Oda.
When the quipu becomes sufficiently vast, it becomes instructive to transition, in our thinking, to a different mode, a continuous as opposed to discrete model, in which all of the threads effectively merge into a block of stuff that I am likening to Jell-O. when we send doers back in time to carry out deeds, it's like tapping the jello with a spoon and making it jiggle a little bit. It creates internal stresses that the material is capable of withstanding. But if we try to change too much, too fast...
Hatcher. It cracks? Oda.
Yes.
Hatcher. It just splits wide open. Oda.
Just for a moment. But, unlike a jello dessert on your plate, the space-time continuum cannot simply fall apart. It is self-healing. The cracks must be sealed immediately. If you are far away from the crack, then you are safe. It's like being far away from an earthquake. But if you are unlucky enough to be right along the crack boundary, then you are in for a bad time. The universe needs to decide whether you are going to go on existing or not.
Hatcher. You're referring here to the so-called tear sheet brewery. What happened in that scenario? Oda.
You might think of the tear sheet brewery as like a lettuce leaf embedded in a jello molded salad. Because of the unfortunate chain of events, this piece of lettuce was yanked out of the jello and ceased to exist. A vacancy was left in its wake, which self-healed with the most terrible consequences for those unlucky enough to be near it.
Hatcher. Terrible consequences indeed. Thank you, Dr. Oda. Madam Chair, I yield my time. Chairwoman Atkinson.
Are there any further questions for Dr. Oda at this time? No? Very well, you may step down, Dr. Oda.
Senator Cole.
Madam Chair, in the light of Dr. Oda's remarks, I would like to call Lieutenant Colonel Lyons back.
Redacted. Senator Cole.
The descriptions of the tear sheet brewery event are, in sum, so blood-curdling, and the benefits of this mission so trivial in comparison, the recovery of an old book from a cask in Dr. Oda's backyard, that it must call into question why we are being asked to spend the taxpayers' money on this sort of undertaking at any level, to say nothing of the exorbitant requests embodied in this proposed budget.
Chairwoman Atkinson.
I would like to thank my distinguished colleague for that impassioned, eloquent, and thorough statement. Was there a question for Lieutenant Colonel Lyons?
Cole.
Why should we spend the taxpayers' money on building a device that will only expose this great nation to additional risk?
Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Thank you, Senator Cole. For high-level strategic questions, I might refer you to General Frink, but I'm happy to address your question on a more nuts-and-bolts level. As you point out, we need to keep the costs as low as possible while minimizing risk and maximizing benefits. From a cost point of view, I'll remind the committee that the only work being actively funded right now, and for the next few months, is CRONE, Chronodynamic Research for Optimizing Next Engagement. We have cut back the number of deeds to the bare minimum needed to sustain progress, and we have limited those to missions of an exploratory or experimental nature. Most of our current budget is devoted to pathfinding work on the Chronotron, a device whose entire purpose will be to minimize risk.
Cole.
To minimize risk, you say?
Lyons.
Yes, Senator. That is its purpose.
Cole.
Both Dr. Oda and General Frink, in their earlier testimony, praised the Chronotron as a tool that would enable Dodo to plan future missions. Would you concur?
Lyons.
Yes, it duplicates the functionality of the quipus or other similar devices used by witches to navigate the different strands of history, and combines that with a colossal database of historical facts. If we'd had it earlier, we'd have planned our first deeds differently and gotten results more quickly and more safely.
Cole.
Or perhaps chosen some different deed altogether.
Lyons.
Yes, it's quite possible that with a functioning chronotron, we might have been able to identify something both easier and more profitable than recovering a Baysalm book.
Cole. This is precisely what concerns me about building the chronotron.